Howdy, I'm Zoe, reader, writer, friend, and you're listening to Broken Spine Social Club, a literary podcast for readers of words. Each week, I sit down with one of my buds to chat about their favorite book. From high modernism to high fantasy, we cover it all, getting to the heart of what makes good writing great or okay writing high impact. So without further ado, welcome to Broken Spine Social Club. Your membership is approved. Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Broken Spine Social Club. I am your host, Zoe Yan, and this episode has been in the making for the last nearly a decade, because today I'm interviewing none other than my very own betrothed, Morris Healy. There's a lot that I love about Morris, but I'm going to keep that to myself because I don't want to sicken my audience before we even get into the meat of the episode. But what I will say is one of my favorite things about my dearest husband is that he is a phenomenal reader. We have the best discussions about books and authors and literature, in addition to things like Peep Show and the Kendrick v. Drake drama, which, God, by the time this goes up, I wonder what new developments there will even be in that world. Fascinating. All of that to say, when I started this podcast, obviously, he was one of my first ports of call for a guest interview. And then when he suggested the book he wanted to read, I was a little iffy, but I gave it a chance, and I am so glad I did, because today we are talking about Flann O'Brien's The Third Policeman. You would think, as someone with two higher level degrees in Irish literature, I would have read any Flann O'Brien, but maybe it's not that surprising given that so much of my time was taking up with Mr. James Joyce. Okay, enough of me humble bragging. Let's get into the episode. I hope you enjoy and happy listening.
So first, let's cheers.
Here, I want to ASMR it.
Cheers.
Oh, I don't know. I think I made it way too strong.
I like it.
I made gin martinis tonight. Dirty martinis. Filthy martinis. Because I've discovered I like them like seawater. And it's a little bit too strong for me, but
it tastes like a fluorescent oil spill. In the best way possible.
Thanks, baby. I appreciate that. Today, we have on an extra special guest, I would say. Squealy Wheelie, Boo Thing, love of my life, man of my dreams.
Goodness.
It's my husband, Morris.
Hi, Zoe. It's great to be here.
Hi, Morris. It's also great to be here in our apartment that we live in.
Together.
Together.
Every day.
Roomy.
Roommates, housemates, lovers, and book lovers.
And best friends.
And best friends. Yes. For sure.
Excellent. Thank you. So as you know, because you are a very strong supporter of all of my many projects, you know that I start out this podcast by asking everyone how we met.
You and me?
Yeah, you and me.
Well, we first met in a Japanese bar in Dublin.
I always like to tell people that we met the old-fashioned way in a bar.
It was the old-fashioned way. It was in a bar. You were doing a master's in Anglo-Irish literature in UCD. And my best friend from childhood, Harry O'Clery, shout out Harry, happened to be doing the same course. And he invited me along to a bar you guys were having drinks at. And I walked in and I saw you. And I was struck by lightning the first time I saw you.
Struck? Oh my God. Yeah, we had just been, me and the course mates had just, the course mates and I. Me, yeah. Anyway. We had all just been to see Observe the Sons of Ulster, which was a play by one of our professors, Frank McGuinness, being staged at Ireland's National Theatre, the Abbey. And from there, we went to Itzakaya.
Itzakaya.
And I also remember you walking in for the very first time because you were wearing a sweater with your own name on it.
Yes, a good thrift find.
But didn't you say you found that on your birthday too? Or is that just to impress me?
Sure. Let's go with that. I can't remember, but if it adds to the story, let's say that I found it on my birthday.
Done. Okay. I remember that. We hit it off that evening. We had a couple of months of will they, won't they. I like to think equal crushes maybe were happening.
I thought mine was, to me, mine was bigger than yours, but I hope they were equal.
I'd say they're pretty damn equal. Yeah. And eventually we got married. How many years were we dating before we got married? Some.
Four?
Four? Maybe four. Yeah, four. It was four. Yeah, I was four. 4 years later, we got married. We have lived between Dublin, mostly Dublin. We were in the States for 6 months, back to Dublin. And now we have recently relocated back to America, or me back to America, you in America for the very first time.
Mm-hmm. In Denver, Colorado.
Yeah, I'm trying to think if there are any other funny anecdotes to our meeting, but
That can be a special episode of the podcast.
Yeah, that can be a special.
Do a full recap.
That can be a special Valentine's Day episode.
Well, it is fitting because I do feel like books and reading.
Oh, books.
Do play a large part in our relationship.
They do. They actually do. So when Morris and I, you and I, first started dating, you were working at Dublin's premier pub, the Lord Ed, on Lord Edward Street. It's across from Christchurch. Exactly. So
beside Leo Burdock's.
Beside Leo Burdock's and Jury's Inn. But we were friends for a while before we formally became boyfriend, girlfriend. And during that time, I was doing a master's in, as previously mentioned, Anglo-Irish literature and drama. But you were kind of like keeping up with our course.
Well, I was hanging out with you and Harry and all our friends so often. And you guys would have drinks and talk about Joyce and Beckett and whatever books you were reading at the time. And I didn't want to feel like a rube and be left out. So I also started reading Joyce and Beckett and other Irish writers, such as Flann O'Brien, who we're going to talk about on this podcast.
Yeah, no, we definitely will. I have to say, I feel so bad for any other American girls who wandered into the Lord Ed during that time, because I can only imagine, having seen you myself, what a strapping caricature I think you probably portrayed, like behind this like kind of seedy old bar reading Ulysses. Like,
I did get tipped by some Americans.
Did you really?
Who saw me reading Ulysses behind the bar in a period of downtime.
That is a great look. That's a good marketing ploy. They should actually make every bartender at the Lord Ed have a copy of Ulysses like on hand.
Mm-hmm. And just flip to a random page.
Yeah, exactly. But very good. So today, though, we are not talking about Ulysses. Thank fuck. We're talking about something pretty goddamn close, though, to be honest.
Ulysses is above my pay grade. But today we're talking about The Third Policeman by Flann O'Brien.
Excellent. Excellent introduction. Yes, Morris has chosen The Third Policeman, a novel by Flann O'Brien. I myself have never read any Flann O'Brien. We didn't touch on him at all during the Masters, actually, which is maybe something we'll talk about. We'll kind of see how the conversation goes. But tell me about you as a reader, of like your history of like, what do you normally read? Have you always been a big reader?
I'm a reader. I read. I grew up a reader. As a kid, I read a lot. The Edge Chronicles. Big fan of The Edge Chronicles. Shout out if you know The Edge Chronicles. Zoe does not.
What are those?
I tried to tell you about it once when we started dating and you told me to
I did. That's getting bleeped. I did not tell you.
Yes, you
that.
Did.
No, I didn't.
You did.
When? Was I half asleep?
Maybe.
Definitely. I wouldn't just tell you to shut up.
It's about flying pirates.
Maybe I did.
Anyway. Read a lot in college as a young man in my 20s. I got very into Kafka. He's a very influential author in my life. And then as we discussed, in my mid-20s, when I met you, Zoe, that kind of spurred me to tackle Irish literature and read the greats like Joyce and Beckett and Flann O'Brien. And that's when I first encountered Flann O'Brien.
Was that year?
I think so, yes. Whoa. I think we had a copy of The Third Policeman in my parents' house somewhere. But as far as I can remember, I think it was that year that I read it for the first time.
It's so interesting because I think I don't know, you can correct me on this. I felt very similar about American literature. It wasn't until I was an adult, like an adult, like past my master's or whatever, that I was like, oh no, actually I want to like read American literature. Growing up in America, it was just something that was so like, ugh, I couldn't give a fuck about it. Like I wanted to read like Irish and British literature.
Yeah, I get that. It didn't really appeal to me growing up because maybe I was too close to it and it didn't seem interesting, but it took a pretty young American woman to make me want to actually read Irish literature.
Thank you. That's really sweet. I just associate you so strongly with reading. Not that it's a competition, but you can you for sure keep up with me. Like, you read so many different things and such a wide variety.
Thank you.
I've always been very impressed by your literary prowess, dare I say.
I appreciate that. You definitely read more than me. Video games and general social media brain rot have definitely dulled my capabilities a little bit, but I like to think I read pretty widely.
You do.
I read a lot of nonfiction.
Yep.
So it was kind of exciting to get to go back for this podcast and reread an old favorite.
I suppose, just to give an overview for those not in the know of the Irish literary canon, which I'm guessing a lot of people won't be. People would probably be familiar with Joyce, with Beckett, and now with fucking Sally Rooney, I guess. But Flann O'Brien was, and please jump in at any time, Morris, an Irish writer born, I think, in like 1911 or so in County Tyrone.
And we should also say, we're going to refer to him as Flann O'Brien because that's the name on the book. That's a pseudonym.
True.
He was born Brian O'Nolan.
Brian O'Nolan. Yeah.
And Flann O'Brien is not the only pseudonym he used.
No. His father was a civil servant who had kind of moved around between Scotland, England, and Ireland, eventually landed the family back in Ireland. Both his father and mother were very strong Irish Republicans, which I need to clarify for any U.S. listeners that that doesn't mean Republican as in the United States GOP or Republican Party. Republican in the Irish context kind of means like an Irish nationalist.
Yes, they believed and worked towards a independent Irish state,
which eventually they got.
Yes, we
good
did.
For them. Well done. Fair play. So from a young age, Flann O'Brien was very, I suppose, probably involved or privy to conversations about politics, political thinking, political life.
Yes.
Eventually, the family moved to Dublin. I think he went to Sing Street for primary school, Christian Brothers School, then Black Rock College. He's a Black Rock boy.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely sending it with
the
lads.
Original Black Rock boy. Sending the pints.
Absolutely sending the pints until he died of alcohol-related health issues. We'll get to that. Then he went to UCD, which is also James Joyce's alma mater.
Mm-hmm. The original UCD.
The original UCD.
Again, some Irish trivia.
Yeah, some I'm,
for listeners.
Irish context for you. Go on, Morris.
The current UCD campus is in South Dublin. The original UCD campus was spread around Dublin city center.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a lot more central, a bit more cosmopolitan, dare I say, around a lot of bars, restaurants, and cool goings-ons.
Yeah, there were cool goings-ons. Also, something that I think is always really interesting about UCD. UCD was like the Catholic response to Trinity because Catholic students couldn't go to Trinity, the Protestant university, for a long time.
Yes. And then they would have to get special permission.
I think up until like the 70s.
The 70s?
I think it was pretty recent.
Jesus.
Yeah.
Well, I went to Trinity. I didn't have to get permission, but the 70s sounds about right. But you would have to get permission from your parish priest to attend the Protestant English college.
Crazy. Wild. While Flann O'Brien, aka Brian Nolan, was at UCD, he started writing and getting very involved with literary society. He joined the UCD, I think, Literary and Historical Society. He was a writer for Fair Play. It was a student newspaper. He took a job in the Irish Civil Service because his father died quite young, quite suddenly. Flann O'Brien was the third of 12 siblings, and when his father died, he kind of had to step up to the plate and provide for his mother and the other like 9 siblings that came after him or whatever.
Yeah. Though they also worked, from what I've read on Wikipedia.
Yeah. Oh, you too read the Wikipedia article.
One was a professor of classics at UCD, I think. Another was an author and writer as well. Mm-hmm. So
an artist. Yeah.
The family got by, but he played a big role in supporting the rest of the kids.
Exactly. He supported them. And the Irish Civil Service was and still is to this day staunchly apolitical of an institution for its employees. Like, employees are not allowed to hold public political beliefs. He was an avid, active writer. And perhaps what he's best known for in Ireland are his satirical kind of letters to the editor to the Irish Times as Miles Nagapoline.
Yes, another pseudonym. He would write a weekly column. Let's go with weekly.
Yeah.
Discussing and skewering the politics and social happenings of the day in Ireland.
Exactly. And he had to maintain this pseudonym so he wouldn't get fired.
Yes.
Although I did read that it was kind of an open secret in the civil service. And he was a very successful civil servant.
Yeah, he was quite high up.
Yeah. I think he was tasked with like trying to plan the first Irish National Health Service based on the UK's NHS.
Yes. And while he was planning and working on that, at the same time, he was skewering his own efforts at setting up this health service in his column.
As Miles McGoblin, aka Miles of the Ponies.
We should really know the name of the column now that we're talking about it so much.
Oh, it's called Kruskeen Lawn.
Excellent, Zoe. Thank you. You did your homework.
I did, yes. I did, yes. So yeah, that was kind of his life until the early 1950s. I've got it written down. Maybe 53? I don't know. He was kind of forcibly retired from his position in the Irish civil service for a couple of different reasons.
Yes, I think
an increasingly reckless
attitude towards his column.
Yes.
And I think a description of a senior politician with a sort of graveyard mouth,
yeah,
with tombstones for teeth, touched a nerve a little too close.
And I think from what I read, a lot of this sort of behavior came because he was an alcoholic and was an alcoholic.
Like, yeah, all the best.
Like,
it's quite sad.
Yeah, it's horrible. Those videos of him, like, doing interviews, like clearly having just fucking drank a whole bottle of Powers.
There's a famous story. I can't verify if this is true or not, but he tried to give up drinking and he used orange juice as a substitute. And within a week or two, he gave himself vitamin C poisoning.
Citrus poisoning.
Because he was drinking so much orange juice in place of Guinness.
Oh my God. He was married, never had any children, lived in South Dublin, wrote for the remainder of his years after being fired from the civil service, still under various pseudonyms, which I guess we can come back to at a later time, and then died in 1966 from a heart attack. So there
no
you go.
No kids.
Moving on to Flann O'Brien's writing, which is very cerebral. I don't want to give shade to any of the other guests, but this is definitely the most literary book I think we've had so far on the Potty Oddy.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Big shoes to fill there.
Okay.
So,
well, I hope I can do it justice.
Yeah, me too, because I am rusty on my old literary theory. Like, even reading this, I was like, I should have better thoughts about this book.
No thoughts, just vibes. That's what I like about Flann O'Brien compared to some of the other 20th century.
Yeah.
Irish greats.
Although he very is in a tradition. Like, reading this, it was like, okay, I'm back to Joyce, I'm back to Beckett. It's the Irish vibe.
Absolutely. And he was a big fan of both.
Yeah.
I think Joyce read and enjoyed his first published book, At Swim Two Birds.
Sorry, I read something crazy. I read that that was the last book Joyce ever read.
I also read that.
How would they verify that? How could they know that?
You know what? I'm not sure, but it sounds really good on paper.
You're
so
right.
I'm sure they ran with it.
But we'll run with
they,
it too.
They used a complimentary quote from Joyce on the blurb,
yeah,
of the book to
help,
well, sell it.
Also, as I understand At Swim Two Birds, it's like different figures from literature and myth are,
yes,
coming together as all the characters in this book.
Yes. Flann O'Brien believes strongly in borrowing and using fictional characters. He didn't think they necessarily belonged to one book or another. So At Swim Two Birds borrows a lot of characters from Irish folklore and mythology. We'll talk about The Third Policeman momentarily. Well, characters from that appear in some of his
other
later writings,
yeah,
as well. And then James Joyce himself appears as a supporting character in one of his later books, The Docky Archives.
I bet he fucking loved that. From beyond the grave.
I don't think he was alive, Zoe.
I said from beyond the grave.
Okay.
Well, now moving on to the old favorite, officially and formally. The book we are discussing today is, as we have mentioned various times, The Third Policeman by Flann O'Brien. The Third Policeman is Flann O'Brien's second novel, although it wasn't published until after his death in 1967.
Mm-hmm.
That's because he had a bit of an ego death with this one. He wrote it shopped it around and no one would pick it up.
No, I think the writer Graham Greene really liked At Swim Two Birds, and he helped get that published. And then in the interim,
he had left
the publishing house.
Yeah.
The publishers weren't very impressed. I think they said, though he's talented, he can be too fantastical, and they want him to go less fantastical. But with The Third Policeman, he went even more fantastical than At Swim Two Birds.
I'll say. There's a really like sad story about when The Third Policeman was not picked up by any publishers. He told people that like he had been on a road trip in Donegal and the trunk of his car was open. And the manuscript like flew out like page by page onto the road. I don't have another one. It's done. It's over. When like really it was on his like sideboard in his dining room and he looked at it every day when he ate for the rest of his life. Like that's really grim.
Well, it's grim, but it's also interesting. As we said, he reused a lot of the characters and ideas in some later books.
Yeah.
But yes, after he died, his wife had the manuscript and she shopped it around and it was published and it's now hailed as a literary masterpiece.
And today we're going to get exactly into why that is or not. So the first thing that I would like to do is give a bit of a brief overview for The Third Policeman. The Third Policeman starts out with an unnamed narrator who goes unnamed for the entirety of the book. He is orphaned from an early age. He has grown up somewhere down the country in Ireland.
Yes.
I think he was raised on like a farm/pub.
Yep.
Yep. He is sent to boarding school where he discovers the fantastical, fabulous works of a philosopher called De Selby.
A fake philosopher.
Good,
called
yes.
De Selby.
A fake philosopher. And he becomes obsessive about De Selby.
Mm-hmm.
He spends a couple of years traveling. He loses his leg. Like, and that's really kind of glossed over.
Yeah, it's a little dark. He says his leg was broken for me.
Yeah.
So you don't really know why, but at some point he acquires a wooden leg.
Exactly. So he's got a wooden leg, and eventually he returns home to the family pub that has been under the management of a man named John Divney.
Yes.
And John Divney has so severely mismanaged this bar that it's like totally out of funds. Nothing's happening. There's no money for anyone.
But at the same time, the only thing the narrator, our hero, really cares about is reading and studying De Selby.
Yeah, he's not interested in the management of the pub at all. And the only thing that kind of starts to spark his interest in funding the pub is that he wants to publish like a very comprehensive study of De Selby to join these De Selby greats scholars, but there's no money. So Divney suggests that they kill local wealthy parishioner.
Old Mahers,
which they do. They murder him with an axe.
A bicycle pump.
Fuck, is it a bicycle pump?
They beat him to death with a bicycle pump and finish him off with a shovel.
Wow, that is very full circle. I really didn't pick up on that at all. I thought it was like an axe or I knew it was a shovel. I did not realize it was a bicycle pump.
Oh yeah, because bikes are...
Well, we'll come back to that.
Bikes play a big role.
They do. They certainly do. After they kill and bury old Mahers, he has cash in a cash box, which Divney won't give to the narrator.
As the narrator is finishing off the old man with the shovel, Divney sneaks off to acquire the cash box and then returns and claims that he's hidden it in a safe place and he won't reveal where that is.
So for 3 years, the narrator won't let Divney out of his sights.
In case he sneaks off to steal the cash box.
Exactly.
Which is funny.
Yes.
They mentioned that neither of them enjoy it, but they gain a reputation around the town as being the firmest of friends for never leaving one another's sides.
Very frenemies lore. Eventually, Divney says that, okay, he's going to reveal where the cash box is. It's time. It's safe. It is buried under some floorboards in old Maher's house. He's going to stand outside and guard while the narrator goes into Maher's house to uncover the cash box.
Yes.
Something very strange happens, though. He goes into the house. It's dark. No one's there. No one's home. He peels up the floorboards. He gets the cash box in his hand.
He finds it exactly where Divney told him it would be.
And then it like...
He opens the cash box and suddenly a great change takes place.
Right. At which point he realizes that Old Mahers is in the house, alive somehow. They have an odd interaction.
The cash box has disappeared somehow.
Yeah, exactly. And the narrator keeps asking Mahers, where's your cash box? Which, very bold. If I had killed a man to steal his money, I certainly would not be asking him where his cash box is.
No. Yeah. Very rude.
Eventually, Mahers tells the unnamed narrator that he should be able to either find it or gain help to find it via these policemen just down the road.
Mm-hmm.
So the next morning, the narrator wakes up and he takes off and he enters the world, I guess we can say, of the policemen. I don't know.
Yeah, it's made clear at the end of the book.
Yeah, true.
To the narrator, he doesn't make clear whether he thinks he is in the same town and village that he's lived in all his life, mm-hmm. whether he's in an alternate universe. We kind of just piece together that strange things happen
exactly.
in this world.
Exactly. So that's kind of, I guess, the background that you need to know, kind of about how we get to the meat of the story. Why did you pick this book? Like, why is it your favorite?
I picked this book because I think it touches on, captures, and predicts a lot of social and literary trends across the 20th and the 21st century. Now, that sounds like a lot. I think when I first read it, I just thought it was funny and clever, mm-hmm. very clever.
Yeah.
But also kind of scary mm-hmm. and kind of sad in mm-hmm. its own way.
Yeah.
And then this is my third time reading the book. Each time I read it, I feel like it's more and more prescient. I think it touches on horror. I think it touches on sci-fi. I think it touches on, you know, philosophical and scientific advancements that we've seen across the last century. I just think Flann O'Brien is a ferociously clever writer. You see him take these scientific and philosophical advancements that were being made in his time, and he manages to put them all together into a very funny but also kind of scary personable story.
Yeah. A few things struck me about this book. First of all, it took me a minute to get through. I'm not going to lie to you.
You didn't love it.
I didn't. The end really redeemed it for me, which we'll come back to in a minute. I don't want to give that away quite yet. It took me a while to get into it, which is really strange because as I was reading it, it reminded me of two of my favorite books from when I was a kid, Alice in Wonderland and The Phantom Tollbooth, which are both stories about a protagonist who enters a world of logic that makes sense, but not to the protagonist.
Yeah, like, the rules are different.
The rules are different, exactly. Like Alice in Wonderland has a very like solid logic to it in a weird way, but it makes no fucking sense to her or to us, obviously, because it's like so illogical. Like it's all rhyming and mind games. The Phantom Tollbooth is the same. That one's a little bit more logical. People might call me out on that if they've ever seen or read The Phantom Tollbooth.
I never have, so I won't call you out.
Thanks, babes. And it really, like, it just rung like that kind of story to me. Like, all of the characters that he runs into in this alternate dimension, I guess we'll call it. Like, first he runs into this other one-legged man who's just, like, smoking a big pipe in the grass. And even the way he leaves the man, you know, it's goodbye, goodbye. And he turns around and just sees, like, a big puff of smoke coming up, like, from this, you know, ditch where he's left this guy. And I was like, that's just, like, that fucking caterpillar in his hookah.
Yeah, and that's a great spot.
Well, thank you.
I never made that connection before.
The other one that really struck me was when he drops the cash box in the house initially or opens it and something happens. I keep saying drop because I have this sense that it like falls and I don't quite know why I have that sense, but it also reminds me of like going down the rabbit hole. Like there's a downward kind of subterranean something. I don't quite know.
Interesting.
Yeah. So it took me a while to get into it because maybe I don't know what I was quite expecting from this.
It's hard to talk about.
It's really hard to talk about. It's basically like for those listening, there's no story kind of after he makes it into this alternate dimension. It's more so him like interacting with and experiencing things.
Yes, and bearing witness to the odd goings-ons.
Yeah.
Of these three policemen.
Exactly. Like the cash box is kind of immediately even thrown out the window. He gets into this alternate dimension. He finds eventually this police station, which is populated by two and then a supposed third police officer. There is Sergeant Pluck, Policeman McCruskeen, and then the kind of mysterious Policeman Fox, who comes in and out once or twice.
Ooh.
But it's really about the narrator just being around these two guys, and they're both very strange men. Like, if we're talking from a purely like plot driven what happens in the book, they're all just kind of talking and going around the countryside.
Yes. Well, so he makes his way down the road,
yeah,
to this police station, and he reports a missing black cash box, and he asks for the policeman's help in locating the box.
Mm-hmm.
They don't really help at all.
No.
We find out that their job mostly consists of moving people's bicycles around in the village because
of the atomic theory?
The atomic theory.
Okay, wait. Again. Explain the atomic theory.
The atomic theory in this book is this idea that the policemen have, that two objects rubbing off each other transfer atoms between each other.
Mm.
So logically, if you spend too long riding a bicycle, you're becoming more like a bike, and the bike is becoming more like a human. So around this village, you know, there's sightings of men who can't stand up straight,
mm-hmm,
and have to lean on walls all the time. Otherwise, they'll fall over, much like a bicycle.
Yes.
And of bicycles sneaking into women's bedrooms to spy on them getting undressed for the night.
Those are very funny bits. So he understands the atomic theory. That's a big piece of thing he learns. Another related kind of experience he has is Policeman McCruskeen has a particular skill creating smaller and smaller and smaller things.
To me, he's an inventor.
McCruskeen.
Yes. Yeah. There's a bunch of wacky gadgets and objects that he presents the narrator throughout the story. Some of those are sequences of ever smaller,
like Russian dolls, but
to a ludicrous degree. He has a collection of wooden chests,
mm-hmm,
each smaller than the last, stored inside the other, and they become so small that you can't even view them with a magnifying glass.
Basically, he's having all these strange experiences. The narrator is meeting all these strange people. At one point, he is accused of murdering a man.
He is rightly accused,
yes,
in a way, of murdering old Myers.
Yes, exactly. And so his crime is found out. He's accused. He's going to be hung or stretched, as they say in this world. Through, again, a fantastic series of wacky happenings, he escapes, gets on a bicycle, has a strange encounter again with Myers, but eventually gets home from this strange place that he's been in. And he walks in the front door of his pub, and Divney is there, except
Divney is old.
Now has a wife, and the wife is pregnant. And Divney sees our narrator and is immediately awash with terror and dies.
Of heart attack.
And as the narrator is trying to help Divney's wife, the wife doesn't seem to notice that the narrator is there. Thus, dun dun dun!
He's been dead the whole time.
He was always a ghost. It's Bruce Willis.
It's Sixth Sense.
I have to say, as soon as I read that, I was like, Jesus, this is just like, even though I've never watched this show before, Lost came to mind. Mm. So I was like, oh fuck, has he just been in purgatory this whole time? Which I don't think he has. I think we can talk about where we think he's been. But I did read that one of the creators of Lost credited this book with the mythology of that entire TV show. And there was an interview done where he mentioned the third policeman, and sales of the third policeman were higher in 3 weeks than they had been in like 6 years prior.
Wow.
Anyway, the point is, yeah, he's been dead the whole time.
Yeah.
And it ends on a really horrifying note for me, which is it's just another page of the book copy and pasted, which is he's just wandering again and he stumbles upon the police station again.
This time joined with the ghost of John Dibney.
Exactly.
Who was also finally perished and is being punished for the murder of old Myers.
Exactly. So they're just doomed essentially to repeat.
And apparently Flann O'Brien said to a friend after writing the manuscript, that the characters are meant to be in hell.
Mm.
And in this instance, hell is a concentric circle where nothing is learned, everything is forgotten and remembered and forgotten over and over again.
That's a scary concept. And this is where the book redeemed itself for me, is throughout the whole course of the book, as our narrator is encountering the atomic theory and these strange inventions that Makrushkin is making and all of this odd stuff, so many pages or paragraphs or sentences are focused on the narrator's visceral, abject confusion and horror.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's so much about him, like, I broke out in a sweat and I felt the deepest pits of dread within my stomach. And the idea of, like, it's not just like you're going through the same thing over and over. It's that he'll have to experience those really, like, strange, horrifying, like, horrific awe, like, over and over and over again for the rest of eternity.
Mm-hmm.
Is really upsetting.
I wouldn't want to do it.
Me neither. Call me crazy. Doesn't seem cool to me. Okay, so we know the general plot of the story. We know the push of the story. We know kind of what happens narratively. Something that is consistently in the book are little interjections from the narrator about his beloved fake philosopher, DeSalby.
Yes.
So a lot of the book is actually written in footnotes about DeSalby. And I guess, what does this do? Like, what does this do for you? What do you think the purpose is? Like, what does he add to the book?
I haven't read a lot, you know, into the theory and science behind the book. To me, as someone who has an undergrad in philosophy and has read a lot of really annoying footnotes, like many things in his writing, I feel like it's probably making fun of and satirizing a certain type of stuck up academic that O'Brien probably encountered in his studies in Dublin. So he's referring to this philosopher DeSalby and many of DeSalby's theories and beliefs, which are all batshit insane.
Yeah.
DeSalby posits that nighttime gets dark because during the day there's a buildup of
pollution
and particle matter that covers the sky in blackness.
And that sleeping is just like a series of fainting.
Yes, that we don't ever truly sleep. We're simply having consecutive mini faints and heart attacks.
I think with the DeSalby stuff, when I was first reading it, I found it quite distracting. In the end, the DeSalby thing ended up doing kind of two different things for me. The first is, I don't know if Flann O'Brien is necessarily mocking a philosopher like DeSalby. I think he's mocking disciples of DeSalby.
Yes.
People like the narrator. Because so much of the footnotes, too, are not even actually about DeSalby. It's about, like, Hatchjaw and Krauss and, like, all of these other scholars.
It's a subplot about these competing DeSalby scholars who are possibly impersonating each other.
Mm-hmm.
There's a murder.
Yeah.
There's a voyage across the sea for Hatchjaw or Lockjaw or whatever his name is to hunt down the evil Krauss, who
may or may not even be Krauss, who might be like the French de Gordier or whoever,
who is publishing competing theories. So I think you're right. That's a good point. I think he's more making fun of people who will take anything a philosopher or a writer says verbatim.
And I think what you get to is you have this unnamed narrator who, it's almost like his only way of making sense of this experience is to attribute it back to this fucking crackpot, DeSalby. Like, there's something about he can't just, like, wander through this world and kind of take it in. He constantly has to go back to this comfort theory.
Yeah.
Whatever.
As a reference point.
Exactly. Instead of just being, like, I don't know if maybe his experience in hell wouldn't be so horrifying if he wasn't so self-reflective about it. But, like, that's who he is, because he's a scholar who's constantly reading between the lines of this insane fucking man's works.
Mm-hmm.
Although, what I will say about DeSalby is towards the end, I was in a similar way that we'll talk about in 2 seconds with atomic theory. It's a point I want to come back to with atomic theory as well. There comes a point where DeSalby's theories end up very, like, logical in the scope and the rules of this alternate universe. And maybe even in the scope of our own universe.
Hmm.
It's when he's talking about water and how water is, like, a peaceful, calming spirit on the mind.
Yes.
That's kind of been proven. Like, there are a couple of different studies. We've talked about this with like green bathing and or forest bathing and that kind of stuff. Biologically, humans calm down when they're around water because it's reminiscent of like, you know, if you're hungry, there's probably food around. If you're thirsty, you know, you drink water, it's safe. Like, there's something about water that I think is very calming. And there's a section that DeSalby has talking about like the calming properties of water. Yeah. I'm not saying all of his theories are correct.
Well, DeSalby, as far as I remember, installs an additional 40 or 50 water pipes.
Yes,
in his house, and floods the entire the entire building just to be around more water. But yeah, I like being around water.
Coming back to this like atomic theory idea, which going back to something that you were saying earlier about how you feel O'Brien is quite prescient.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the word I'm looking for? Forward looking, you know, about theories, scientific and philosophical, that ended up becoming true or well known or well circulated.
Yeah. So we talk about the atomic theory, mm-hmm. the exchange of particles between different objects. Obviously, as far as I know, a man doesn't become a bicycle if he rides a bike for too long. But even the idea of just discussing and having fun with the idea of atoms and particle exchange. There's another invention of Makrushkin's that captures noise and converts sound into energy to light a lamp.
Not dissimilar to Monsters, Inc.
Not dissimilar to Monsters. another excellent insight, Zoe.
Thank you. Where they use the screams to
power the Monster Society.
I wonder if...
That's an excellent point.
Thank you. But I'd love to see if there's a link between whoever wrote Monsters, Inc. and the Third Policeman.
You should do a follow-up episode on
this. Yeah, I really should.
But again, this idea of like energy taking different forms. I wouldn't call him a scientist by any sense, but he's obviously comfortable learning about and incorporating these different scientific theories, which have proven to be, I'm not going to say correct, but certainly relevant to how we, you know, conceive of the world today.
Yeah, I think something that was really interesting for me and is interesting, and I don't know if you're going to roll your eyes at my ooby-joobiness trying to weave it into this conversation as I do all conversations. There comes a point where like spirituality and science become the same thing. Mm-hmm. I think that, I don't know if everyone in the world thinks that, but I certainly think that like things like quantum physics, you're getting into a space where the language people have used to describe certain spiritual or metaphysical phenomenon is being proven by quantum theories. And this book is almost quite similar in a smaller scope in a way, like it's philosophy and science. The idea of hell being a repeated place over and over and over again, because there's only so much matter, experience, I don't quite know, which is similar to this idea that, yeah, you know, there are only a set amount of particles in the world and all the matter that's here is here.
Yeah.
If I am remembering matter correctly.
No, that's a good point. Again, another discovery he's confronted with is omnium, a substance that makes up everything in the universe.
Mm-hmm.
He's told towards the end of the book that the cash box isn't full of cash. It's full of this material called omnium, which he can use to create anything he wants.
Right.
But again, this idea of an underlying scientific or spiritual substance making up our reality.
And that's like the book, for as illogical as it seems, ends up feeling quite logical. Like the one I keep coming back to is Makrushkin, and he's making these tiny, tiny, tiny little chests. It's like, yeah, eventually you could just get so small that it's not conceivable to the human eye. I mean, yeah, you couldn't really do that, you know, carving little chests, but the idea is there.
There's an idea.
There's.
I think what you're trying to say is that these ideas, though they're ridiculous, they're at least internally consistent to the world that Flann O'Brien has created.
Exactly. Something that I think is interesting about Flann O'Brien and about a lot of contemporary, modern and contemporary Irish writing, kind of post-Joyce, is this pastiching. So in At Swim Two Birds, you see it, as we discussed earlier, with character. I wonder if The Third Policeman is doing that same kind of thing with genre. Because I think this is like typically billed or sold as like a comedy.
Yeah.
But it's also a horror. It's also science fiction. It's also philosophy. Like, it doesn't rest easy in any kind of category.
No, I think you're right. And it's like he's drawing together and, to my mind, predicting some of these different genres and putting them all in a tasty stew.
Stir about, if you will.
I'm a big H.P. Lovecraft fan. Not of the racist stuff, just the stories. But a lot of the horror of Lovecraft is, you know, the human mind be confronted with these
concepts.
These concepts or beings that are outside of our reality and that we can't even comprehend. There's a point in this book when McCrushky paints a bicycle in a color that he has discovered that the human mind cannot comprehend. To fend off an invading army of one-legged men who have come to rescue the narrator, and he wears a blindfold himself, cycles out into the countryside, and drives these one-legged men insane with the color. To me, that's pure Lovecraft.
Yeah, isn't that literally Cthulhu?
Cthulhu.
Is that Cthulhu? Is that if you look upon him, you go crazy? Or am I just thinking of God?
Well, that's any...
Or any.
Any of these...
Take your things. Pick.
Yeah. Just the very concept, that idea, I think you can trace directly back to The Third Policeman.
Or again, just at a very basic level, that he's been dead the whole time. Like, I was like, is this the first time that that's been... Surely not. No. Maybe. I don't know. Surely not.
Probably not, but probably I can't say for definite not.
No, like, I'm thinking... I mean, I've never read every book ever, but...
You haven't?
Oh, you haven't? But I guess, like you know, my... I'm trying to think of what, like, a similar popular narrative is. A similar well-known book that has a similar theme, and the only thing I can think of is A Christmas Carol. But he's not dead the whole time. He's just... What if he was dead? Like, that's a different thing, so... It felt really shocking. Like, when you find out that he's dead.
It's a good twist.
It's a great twist. Like, I wasn't expecting it. I did not think that that's what had happened at all. And I was very surprised. And then what I loved most about it, it was a twist that made sense. Like, looking back on the rest of the book, you're like, oh, yeah, he's obviously been dead this whole time.
And we should say, I don't know if we've clarified, he's dead because...
Oh, yeah, we haven't said.
John Divney has planted a bomb... in the cash box.
Exploded him.
So he, as soon as he opened the box, he is blown to smithereens.
Pieces of DeSelby all over the wall.
Well, his name isn't DeSelby.
I know, but...
This book touches on science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
There's a part in the book where the policemen take him to visit Eternity.
Yeah.
Which is...
Very Wonka.
Very Willy Wonka. Very Willy Wonka coded.
Willy Wonka coded.
Good point. It turns out that Eternity is behind a hedge in the countryside, down a magical elevator, and is basically just a series of infinite engine rooms.
Yeah, like pipes and wires and shit.
Pipes, wires, clocks, steam, perhaps. In which you can generate anything your heart desires. You know, the narrator fills up a sack full of
riches.
Gold coins, riches, jewels, fine whiskeys, but then anything...
No, he can't take it with him. Like, he's about to step onto the elevator to go back up to normal land.
Yeah.
And McCrushkin and Pluck are like, whoa. Basically, the narrator cannot take his loot on the elevator. It'll kill him or something like that because they're in a different space altogether.
Yeah, we're a space outside of time.
Exactly.
Engine rooms with strange machinery and equipment. I think is quite sci-fi.
Very sci-fi. It is. I had a very steampunky kind of image in my head of Eternity.
There's so much that we haven't touched on and that we could. We haven't even mentioned that aside from the footnotes, throughout the book, the narrator is also accompanied by the voice of his internal conscience.
His soul.
Joe. He names him Joe. That's another character who is commenting
yes.
on all... The happenings in the story.
Yes. Something about Joe, again, if we're going back to this idea of like an Alice in Wonderland narrative logic system or universe logic system, there's the constant repetition, the constant idea of either things getting smaller and smaller and smaller, or things repeating themselves over and over and over again, much like a bicycle wheel.
I like it.
But there's a very strong moment where the narrator is considering his own death. He's going to be hung the next day. And Joe says, listen, page 119. Listen, before I go, I will tell you this. I am your soul and all your souls. When I am gone, you are dead. Past humanity, it is not only implicit in each new man born, but is contained in him. Humanity is an ever-widening spiral, and life is the beam that plays briefly on each succeeding ring. All humanity, from its beginning to its end, is already present, but the beam has not yet played on you.
Wow. That's beautiful.
It is beautiful. It really is. And I'm going to be very honest with you, Morris. I think it's incredibly clever. I think that if I had read this book back maybe 4-6 years ago, I would have loved it. I think I'm just a little tired. What I mean to say here is I have encountered so many people trying to be like this book at this stage, having done 2 different degrees in Irish literature.
Yeah.
And I wish that I had discovered this one first.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. Very clever, poorly imitated.
Perfect. Applause. That's exactly how I feel. Like, I've just seen a lot of writing that is very much so trying to be like this. And I'm just a little bit exhausted of it. I would be curious to know Flann O'Brien's relationship with Beckett, because this was very Beckett to me as well.
It's funny.
A lot funnier openly, but I think Beckett's a little quite funny too.
Well, that's interesting. I actually have no idea.
Yeah, I didn't see anything about, because they would have been not too far off.
No, and O'Brien did unsuccessfully dabble in theater as well in his lifetime. I will say, for your prospective readers out there, to me, the big three of Irish literature are Joyce, Beckett, and Flann O'Brien. Joyce is obviously incredible, a fucking pain in the ass to read.
Mm-hmm.
You kind of got to do your homework. It's kind of a chore.
It is, yeah.
As I know from reading it to try and impress you. I'm going to out myself as an ignoramus. I don't like Beckett. I've read Beckett.
I like Beckett.
Well, agree to disagree. I got nothing from reading Beckett. Whereas I think, let me finish my thought.
Yeah.
I think Flann O'Brien splits the difference between Beckett and Joyce incredibly well. I think it's clever. It's witty. He's pulling in characters and references from so many different sources. But he's also just a gas drunk man, I don't know, having the crack and trying to make himself laugh. This is not a long book.
No.
It sounds like it is because there's so much in it.
Yeah.
It's not a long book. I think it's very readable if you're willing to give it a chance.
And it
I
is.
Think it pay, I think it pays that chance back.
No, I agree with you. And I think that is an exceptionally astute and perfectly put way of putting it. I think on a very just purely personal level, I think that if I had read this book before Beckett, I would have much preferred this.
Mm.
I just read Beckett before I read Flann O'Brien, and they are quite similar, but Beckett's just a little more artsy about it, if that makes sense. Like, I think Beckett's very funny. Anyone listening to this podcast is going to turn it off now and never listen again, because they're like, these two fucking people.
These two assholes.
Are insufferable. Sitting in their apartment drinking martinis talking about Beckett on a fucking Saturday night.
Did we mention we're drinking martinis?
And the martinis are great.
Before we close out, I once attended a talk at a ghost story festival in Dublin, by the American author Joyce Carol Oates.
Very good memory.
Who, ironically, I've never actually read. I have an autographed copy of one of her books somewhere, which I will read someday. But, you know, she did a Q&A with the crowd, and someone asked her, are there any genres that ghost stories don't work with or mesh with? And she said, comedy. She said she doesn't think that there can be a funny ghost story. And I stood in the crowd and thought, I'm too shy to say anything. But if I wasn't, I would say that I think you're wrong. The Third Policeman is a hilarious ghost story.
Oh, Mrs. Oates, have you heard Flann O'Brien? Oh, oh, sorry. I mean, Mrs. Joyce Carol Oates.
That's what it would have sounded like. So I just stood there.
This is actually both equal parts funny and scary.
Yeah. It's not Casper.
It's not.
This ain't Casper, baby.
Hey, okay, little babies. If you think that you're just going to sit down and read Casper.
This, it's not a little white ghost named Casper with some other evil green ghosts.
That's Ghostbusters.
No, aren't the bad ghosts in Casper green?
No, too? I think they're just fat.
Oh, I think you're right. They're just weird shapes.
Yeah. Are they his brothers or his uncles? Who are
they
those?
Related?
I mean, he's a minor. Can't be living alone. Surely they're his guardians. Next of kin.
No, but aren't they evil?
I don't think they're evil. I think they're ornery.
That's a great word, Zoe.
Thank you.
If you haven't turned off the podcast by now, you probably will soon.
Okay, for real, my last thing, and then we'll stop talking about this, and we'll get your recommendations, and we'll close out. One of the very first things I highlighted, it was Sergeant Pluck talking about how all of this was the fault of the county council, which is actually never really returned to.
No, that's a very Irish attitude.
But I underlined it. I was like, oh, I understand why Morris likes this book. Because not only is that just like a funny like quip, you know, an Irishy thing, but it reminded me a lot of Kafka.
Yes. Well, thank you for bringing this up.
You're welcome. I knew you were waiting for that one.
Yes, I think there is, you know, something about these inept, strange policemen that nods to Kafka and his, you know, conception of these bizarre, unknowable bureaucracies that we just run up against in modern life. And having read a lot of Kafka, all of Kafka, perhaps, maybe.
You've read more than I have.
I'm going to say all of Kafka. I think I've read all of Kafka.
I won't fight you on that.
And a lot of Flann O'Brien. I do think there is, to me, a very clear link there between an innocent or not so innocent bystander running up against something unscrutable and uncaring.
Yeah.
That's blocking them from achieving whatever their goal may be.
Definitely. Absolutely. And again, like, I also think Kafka's funny. Not ha-ha funny. Not really funny.
But you might chuckle to yourself. Once or twice. Not funny like Casper funny, but funny.
And then I know you've been chewing on this all day. To close out, what else would you recommend to our readers? You've recommended us your favorite book, or our listeners, rather. Are there any other books, foods, television programs, video games, cow print belts, snakeskin loafers?
Well, I have recently got a pretty cool cow print belt, but I won't talk about that. I will recommend a TV show based on a book, which wrapped up, called Shogun, which is on Hulu. It's based on the book called Shogun by James Clavell. It's not a true story, but it's based on a true story of an English sailor who arrives in pre-Edo Japan.
Yeah.
I can't remember what century it is.
I think it's Edo.
I think it's pre-Edo.
Pre-Edo.
It's Pre-Edo Japan. With the intention of challenging the Portuguese monopoly over trade with the Japanese, but ends up becoming embroiled in some political intrigue instead.
To quote our good friend Owen Hardy,
it's full of political intrigue and sexy young ones.
Which is a ringing endorsement if I've ever heard one.
Yes. It just finished up. Go watch it.
I'm going to recommend something this week as well. Having a husband like Morris, thank you so much for joining.
Aww.
It's been great being married to you and talking about your favorite book with you on this week's episode of Broken Spine Social Club.
Thank you, baby. I hope I got to come back again sometime.
We'll see.
Okay.
No. You'll come back.
Okay.
Love you.
Love you too.
Bye. Aw, thank you so much, Morris, for coming on and talking to me about The Third Policeman. And thank you to my wonderful listenership for bearing with me as we talked about just the arsiest stuff in the world, Beckett, Joyce. But look, that's what this is. There's something to be gained from every book, even if it's something that you might not decide to pick up at a first glance, which is certainly the case with me and Flann O'Brien. We'll be back same time, same place next week for more conversations about books with my buds. But in the meantime, if you just can't get enough Broken Spine bookish content, do give us a follow over on Instagram. We are at Broken Spine SC. That's over on Instagram. And finally, if you love this podcast as much as I love you, do us a big solid. Please rate, review, and leave us 5 stars. In the meantime, I hope you keep reading whatever keeps the pages turning, and we'll see you next week.